Okay, good morning, everyone. Welcome to a new series. Welcome to a new Bina term. Hope everyone is doing well. It's kind of strange that we're sort of back where we started in last year. But as we know, as we've talked about so much and during this series and others, and everything happens for a reason. Everything is b'hashgacha pratit. So therefore, we make the most of it. We keep learning. We keep growing in whatever way we're allowed to. So just to give you a little bit of introduction and context of the series. So a while back, I don't know where I was, maybe in a store somewhere, but a book caught my eye just by the title. I just like the title. The title was 13 Things Mentally Strong People Don't Do. It's by Amy Morin. This is what the book looks like. And it was a while back, and I put it on the shelf, and it joined the queue of many books that I've been waiting to be read. Get to them eventually. And eventually I did read it, and it caught my eye originally because even from the title, it seemed to have ideas and explore ideas from that are very, very much in line with Jewish thinking. So this series I've titled A Strong Mind, and as always, we're going to look at some of the, not only the concepts of the book, but base it on the book as a structure, and explore the ideas, and explore them, of course, from a Jewish perspective, and to understand how they fit into the way, the appropriate way, the legitimate way, and the good way of thinking to be able to be strong, have a strong mind, and to grow. Just to give a little introduction, the author of the book, Amy Morin, is a therapist herself. She's a person who suffered significant challenges in her life. Now, I just want to point out, as I always do, I'm probably boring whenever I say this, but I say it every series that we do things like this. When we talk about challenges happen on many, many layers. They happen in the small challenges that we experience every day. Some of them are more significant than others. Some of them are more challenging than others. Some of them are more challenging to some people than others. And of course, those are challenges which we know we can overcome, and the concepts we'll talk about certainly help. But then, of course, there's greater challenges that people experience that are legitimate, that are painful, that are very painful, like tragedy and loss and grief and so on and so forth, and sometimes in very tragic circumstances. And I never, ever want to come across as belittling those, because challenges are real, especially tragedies are real, and the pain is real. However, having said that, and taken from the author's book, first of all, we always talk about things in the extreme because it's easier then to apply to less extreme circumstances. And also some of these ideas, in the right time, when people are ready, and everyone that's different, some of these ideas could be helpful as well. But never meant, God forbid, to belittle people's challenges or the things that they go through, because that's really, really important. So as I said, the author is a therapist herself, and she's someone who went through a significant amount of challenges. And after she writes about the time that she lost her mother prematurely, untimely passing of her mother, and she writes the following. She says, at the time, I was working as a therapist at a community mental health center. So I took off a few weeks to privately deal with my grief. I knew I couldn't be effective in helping others unless I was able to productively deal with my own feelings. Becoming used to a life that no longer included my mother was a process. It wasn't easy, but I worked hard to get myself back on my feet. From my training as a therapist, she says quite an important thing now. She says, I knew that time doesn't heal anything. It's how we deal with that time that determines the speed at which we heal. Understood that grief was the necessary process that would eventually alleviate my pain, so I allowed myself to feel sad, to get angry, and to fully accept what I truly lost when my mother passed away. So this is a really important paragraph, because what she's essentially saying, and very much in line with Jewish concepts that we've talked about many times, that first of all, being mentally well or having a strong mind, right, does not mean rejecting or denying pain. That's really important. We've said this many times, but it's really important. The second thing that she's really making the point, and I think it's an important point, because people talk about time healing. Time doesn't heal always. But what time does do is, if people use the time correctly, and it's important to give a time, and again, like I said before, everyone has different stages of time that they need, depending on the situation, depending on the experience. it gives us space. It gives us space to manage our emotions, to process, to develop thinking attitudes and mindsets that allow us to strengthen, to manage and deal with our own challenge in order to move on in a positive way, and to be productive and to have that strong and healthy mind going further. Because that is the process which you all want to try and go through, and that's the most effective outcome of any experience that a person has, is to be able eventually to move forward strongly and productively and in a meaningful and purposeful way. So what she does in this book eventually, and she went through many, many other situations, and from her own experience and a therapy background, she writes what she writes. There's also a TED talk that she gives, which is interesting. You can look her up. So this book starts off, well, this book is based on 13 things that you shouldn't do. But that's actually important. Why is that important? Because, you know, even in Judaism, we have this concept. We have a Torah, and the Torah has mitzvot. And we know that in our Torah, there are two things. There's what we call sur meira, going away from bad, and then doing good. And they're two separate things. Because it's not just enough to do good things. It's not just enough to engage in positive experiences, be it mitzvot or healthy mindsets or good practices or healthy practices. That's not enough. As she writes herself, she says, good habits are important, but it's often our bad habits that prevent us from reaching our full potential. This is actually an amazing line because, you know, I shouldn't say this really, but because I have a passion for personal growth, as you all know, and I read a lot about it, and I'm passionate about it. Inevitably, I try not to do this, but inevitably I kind of analyze people sometimes. None of you, don't worry. And I'm certainly not an experienced and skilled psychoanalyst or psychotherapist, whatever the case is. So please still come back. But nevertheless, in my few years of experience, I've seen people who really mean to do well. They're honestly sincere people. Sincerely, spiritually, emotionally, they really want to be meaningful people who do the moral thing, the ethical thing, the right thing. And they really even want to grow. If you ask them, they'll tell you, yes, we need to grow every year and so on. But they're very trapped people. And obviously, and often not very productive. And people who actually don't let themselves grow and don't let others enter into good relationships with them, because they have certain perspectives, certain mindsets, certain attitudes that are just blocking them. They're standing in the way. And because they're standing in the way, all the good things that they want to engage in really doesn't work very well. Right? And this is what she writes. She says, good habits are important, but it's often our bad habits that prevent us from reaching our full potential. You can have all the good habits in the world, but if you keep doing the bad habits alongside the good ones, you'll struggle and reach your goals. You'll struggle to reach your goals, sorry. Right? And she says like this, a great analogy. She says, bad habits are like heavy weights that you drag around as you go about your day. They slow you down, they tire you out, they frustrate you. And she gives afterwards a beautiful analogy. She says, picture a person, right, who goes to the gym every day. He works out for almost 2 hours. He keeps a careful record of the experiences of the exercise he performs so he can track his progress. Over the course of 6 months, he isn't noticing much of a change. He feels frustrated that he's not losing weight or gaining muscle. He tells his friend that it doesn't make sense why he's not looking and feeling so much better, right? After all, he really misses a workout. What he leaves out of the equation, of course, is that what he does is that on the way home, when he drives back from the gym every day, he indulges in all these unhealthy treats, right? Because when he finishes, he feels very hungry, and he tells himself, you know, I've worked hard, and I deserve a treat. Well, it doesn't work, right? So this is a ridiculous analogy, but the truth is we all do the same thing. We all feel sometimes entitled to engage in bad habits or bad mindsets or bad attitudes because we have so many good points. It doesn't work like that. We have to make sure that as much as we can, we remove unhealthy mindsets. We remove unhealthy unhealthy attitudes. Now, you know, we have a source for this, such a strong source that we've talked about often, but it's such an amazing thing. You know, when the Jews left Egypt, and we often talk about the Jews leaving Egypt because the Jews leaving Egypt was very much of an inner spiritual freedom. And we know that, of course, we've talked about this before, that Mitzrayim, Egypt, is like the self-confinement. So when people are trapped, we all have our own Mitzrayim. And then going out of Egypt, going out of Mitzrayim, is freeing ourselves from ourselves, being able to grow and able to go forward. But what's fascinating is that when God told Moses that he was going to take the Jews out of Egypt, he told them four expressions of redemption. And he says, the first three, he says, I will take you out of Egypt, I will redeem you, I will save you. And then the fourth one, he says, I will take you as a nation. And if you have a look at it carefully, you'll see that the first three is not about what they're going to do, it's about what they're going to move away from. And then he says, I'm going to make you as a nation. Which creates an incredible formula for growth and a healthy mind. And the formula is, you have to let go of stuff that's standing in the way. You have to be able to remove unhealthy mindsets, unhealthy attitudes, unhealthy patterns of thinking, messages of the brain. We need to let go of them. We need to remove them. But it also tells us by the fourth expression that when you do remove them, and this is very much part of this book as well, when you do remove them, you can't just leave a vacuum. You have to replace them with something positive. Which is why we are taught that when God said the four expressions of redemption, he said, I will save you, I will take you out of Egypt, I will redeem you. And then he says, but I will take you as a nation, which is a positive thing. It's not only what you're going to move away from, it's also what you're going to become, right? And that's really, really important, because, in other words, both things are important. You have to have the first three stages. You have to move away, you have to let go. But then you also have to engage in something positive. So, as I said before, and I just want to quote Edith Eger, because we did her books. She's, you know, obviously the examples that we talk about or mention in the book, and sometimes we use them, are extreme examples, and sometimes have to do with real challenge or real grief or whatever the case is. But like Edith Eger said in her second book, The Gift, she says all therapy is about grief because it's loss of expectation, which means that small losses or big losses, small challenges or big challenges, it's always, often, or most times, about things that we expect to happen and they don't happen. And so we lose an expectation and then we have to deal with it. Sometimes it's easier, sometimes it's harder, sometimes we need less time, sometimes we need more time. They're always real and we always have to give it some time, but we have to always try and move towards a healthy sort of state of mind. What I'm doing, by the way, of today, of course, is the first part of today's session, is I'm doing an introduction to the whole concept. But I'm going to get to the first habit that she talks about, but we're just doing a bit of introduction. So, this is common sense, but in the introduction, she says, of course, that there are several factors, there are several things, of course, that determine why a person can or cannot or finds it difficult or easy to develop what we call mental strength. Obviously, genetics is a part of the process. It's how a person is born. Some people are prone to be more weaker, to be more frazzled, to be stronger, to be more resilient, less resilient, and so on. Personality, just the personality of a person, which again is determined by so many different things. And experiences of trauma, experiences of challenge, very, very much in our younger years, particularly the experiences that we experience even later on, obviously have a lot to do with the way we think and the way our mind is strong or weak. Now, some of these things, of course, you can't change, right? She gives the example of a child that is ADHD, whatever. That's a genetic thing, right? But it doesn't mean, it never means, as we've talked about so often, that we cannot choose to strengthen our mental state. Now, when I say choose to strengthen our mental state, I don't mean mental health. I don't mean when someone is stricken by real mental health issues, which are often clinical, and something that that some people are unable to fix or to improve, right? It's like I often talk about, you know, things with a small letter or a big letter. When they clinically plague a person, that can be just a real disease, and not just like a person cannot necessarily take away their heart condition or any other health condition that they have. They can try to do things that improve it and try to get the right cure, sometimes works, sometimes doesn't, but doesn't mean they can intrinsically change it. But when we talk about just our disposition towards different states of mind that we have, those are things that we can, with a lot of strength, a lot of hard work, we can choose to change or we can choose to improve. Now, she says something in the introduction, which I want to just mention, because it's something that we've talked about before, and it's something that we've talked about from a Jewish perspective and a very, very, talked about in Kabbalah and in sources that deal with the makeup of the person. But she says that the mental strength of a person depends on three things. It depends on thoughts. I think what she means by that is the way we think, the way we process information. It depends on behavior and it depends on emotion. All right. And essentially, what she does in the book is suggest something that we've talked about before, but we need to just revisit it for a few minutes in order to give the right foundation and introduction to what we're going to talk about. And that is the essential truth that those three layers of the human being, cognition, the way we process things in our brain, emotion, which is how we respond emotionally to things, and behavior, those action, behavior, those are the three layers. Of those three, the ones we can actually change is the mind, the thought, and our behavior. We can choose different way of thinking. It's hard sometimes. And we can certainly choose ways of behaving. What is actually impossible to change is our emotions. Now, when I say it's impossible to change, it's impossible to change, but it's possible to control. That's very different. Guide, channel, right? And therefore, in this book, as we've talked about many times, in this book, she talks about the 13 things that we have to let go of, that those are the 13 mindset patterns that are unhealthy and destructive and stand in the way of moving forward. But she also is very strong on choosing the right behaviors, because action also controls our emotion. So when we choose the right way of thinking, and then we also engage in healthy behaviors, whether we want to or not, but we're able to choose to do it, right? When we do that, our emotions change. Now, they don't change, they're controlled. It's very hard to intrinsically change an emotion because they keep coming up. What I mean by that is, just to explain, in books of Kabbalah and mysticism, particularly in the book of Tanya, talks about that for most people, they actually can't really change their emotions. They can control their emotions, right? So what I mean by that is they can change the expression of their emotions. They can become less jealous. That doesn't mean that if I control my jealousy, that next week I won't be tempted to be jealous again. And that's why, by the way, often personal growth becomes an ongoing struggle or an ongoing process. We don't just improve and engage in personal growth and then goodbye, I'm done, I'm fixed, I'm now a healthy person emotionally. No, it's continuous. Now, the goalposts, of course, do change. We hope so, because when you do something many, 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 many times, if you control your anger many, many times, you become less of an angry person. That is true. But it's a little bit like addictions. You know, it's a little bit like alcoholism. They talk about never being cured from being an alcoholic. You can always control it. You can always choose to make the right decisions with the right therapy and the right process, but we never really cure it. Same things with some of our intrinsic emotional dispositions. We can channel it to a more positive state. We can replace it from a negative expression to a positive expression. We've talked about many examples of this in the past. We can use gevurah in a bad way, in a good way, and so on and so forth. But that doesn't mean that we won't have a struggle. It doesn't mean that it won't pop up again. But if we develop the right mindsets and we engage in the right behaviors continuously and we practice it, it becomes easier. So we're more sort of controlling and guiding the emotions, but and hopefully putting it into a good pattern of behavior and response and disposition and instinctive responses and so on. But the things that we really have to tackle is the way we think and the way we behave. And that's really the basis of this book. Now, I want to just share with you an idea. And I'm doing that because it really highlights the point, but also because it has to do with the time of year that we're in. I want to share with you a beautiful concept that has to do with the Beit HaMikdash, the temple, the two temples that stood in Jerusalem, which we mourn the destruction of them this coming Sunday. So right now we're in the 3 weeks, as we call it, the 9 days. We're in a period which is a sad period, a period of mourning, culminating in the ninth day of Av, which is this Sunday, where we mourn the destruction of the both temples that stood in Jerusalem. The first temple that King Solomon built, it was roughly around 500 before the Common Era. It was more like it was earlier than that, much earlier than that, and then it was about 800 before the Common Era. And then that was destroyed after standing for 410 years. The Jews went into Babylonian exile. They then came back, and Ezra built the second temple, which for most of the time they were under foreign rule. We've talked about this a little bit before, the Greek rule and then Roman rule and so on. And then eventually in the year 69 or the year 70, it's unclear exactly which year, after about 420 years of standing in Jerusalem, it was destroyed by the Romans. Now, so it was the destruction of the two temples was a tragic event. It happened, they both happened on the same day, Tisha B'Av, which is a day that many other tragedies happened. It's a day of national mourning. It's a day that we focus on what we lost. We focus on the beauty of what once was in Jerusalem, that temple. We pray for its rebuilding, and so on and so forth. And therefore, during this time, it's often a time where people actually reflect on the actual building. It wasn't just a building. It was a headquarters of Jewish consciousness. It was a headquarters of divine presence. It was an amazing experience to visit the temple, and so on and so forth. But the temple, as it stood in Jerusalem, wasn't just a building in the sense of an exact geographic location. It was also a model. The way it was built and the objects that it contained was also very much a model for ourselves, for to building what we call the temple of the soul. How to make our life a valuable entity and a place of holiness and a place which is meaningful and purposeful and a place where kind of God can feel comfortable, right? And this, of course, is based on a verse early on in the desert where God commands the Jewish people to build a mishkan, a temporary sanctuary in the desert, which traveled with them in the 40 years of the desert. And there's a very interesting verse that says there, that Ve'asulim mikdash, make for me a sanctuary and I will dwell in them. It doesn't say I will dwell in it, it says I will dwell in them. Which means, as our sages teach us, that what God was saying is, build for me a sanctuary, but the sanctuary is just a model for me then to be able to dwell within each and every single person. So let me show you one idea and a beautiful concept that's relevant to the discussion that we're having. So the temple was a very complex building, but it essentially had three areas. Two of them were inside with a roof. One was more in the courtyard. The three areas was, one was a very, very holy room. It was the holiest spot called the Holy of Holies, which that room housed, in the first temple at least, the Aron Kodesh, the Holy Ark, which contained the tablets that was given by Moses and a Torah scroll. It was a very holy room, and that was the room, the foundation, the center of the temple. It was the room that the Kohen Gadol, the high priest, would go in on Yom Kippur to pray and atone for the Jewish nation, and so on and so forth. Then there was another room called the Kodesh, which housed three important objects. It was the candelabra, the menorah, which was kindled every day. There was a little altar on which incense was brought every day. There was a table which had on it the 12 miraculous showbreads, which was replaced every Shabbat, and so on. And then you had the courtyard with the big altar where most of the activity used to take place every day with the sacrificial rituals and so on and so forth. Of course, now's not the time to go into all of that in detail. But the mystics explain that these three areas of the temple mirror and represent the three layers of the human being, which we just spoke about before. The Holy of Holies, which had the Aron, the Ark. The Ark meant the Ark had in the Torah, which is our value system. The value system that lives in the mind. Things we believe in, things we understand, things we process, things which we put through our cognitive journey to come to it and to internalize and believe in and hopefully become one with and believe in with conviction. The good things, in other words, that's the Aron, that's the teachings, the morality of the Torah that we are guided by, and that's our moral compass and so on, and that represents everyone's values. Then you had the room of the three objects, which represents our emotional structure, because as we've talked about in the past, our emotions are governed by three primary forces called Chesed, Gevurah, Tiferet. So that's the emotional structure. And then the outside, which is the activity center of the temple, represents our behavior. Now, here's an interesting thing. The holiest spot of the temple was the Holy of Holies, and it had the Aron Kodesh, the Ark, which has the Torah, which represents the thinking, the learning, and the values of a person. That wasn't around in the second temple. It was an empty room. Why wasn't it around? Because King Solomon, when he built the first temple and wanted to, and put the Ark in that room, in the Holy of Holies, And this ark, by the way, was the ark that was built by Moses. It was the most holiest object that the Jews ever had and have. King Solomon knew that one day it will be destroyed, the temple. And therefore he created underneath the Holy of Holies a very complex tunnel system, we believe, and the Rambam talks about this. And towards the end of the first temple, with where things weren't looking very good, there was a king, one of the kings, decided to act, and he hid the ark. He hid the ark underneath, very deeply underneath, the Holy of Holies. And Jewish belief is that the ark is still there, in that very complex tunnel system, in a chamber, which we don't know how to get there, we wouldn't know how to find it, even archaeologically, because it is so complex to get there. That was the wisdom of Solomon. But because it was so hidden, no one ever found it again. And therefore, in the second temple, they built a temple, but in fact, the ark wasn't there. And of course, the obvious question is, well, if the ark wasn't there in the second temple, what was the point of the ark? What was the point of the temple, if the foundation of the temple wasn't there? And also, why did King Solomon do that? How do you build a temple, and when you're building it, you're already thinking of it being destroyed? You know, there are good things that happen to us in life, and there are bad things, and sometimes we build and sometimes there's destruction, but when we build, we should focus on what's good. But King Solomon doesn't do that. King Solomon builds a temple, and he's already worried about its destruction. And let me share with you an unbelievable thought that I've taught in different contexts in Shiurim, but let me share with you this idea. When King Solomon built the temple, he knew the temple would be destroyed, but he wanted to make one part of the temple eternal. So the fact that he created a tunnel system and a very deep chamber in which to hide the temple, it was actually the opposite. What he was really doing is he was ensuring, he was guaranteeing, because that room that he built underneath the Holy of Holies, what he did was, as the commentaries explain, he extended the holiness of the temple all the way down to that room. In other words, what he did was that even if there was going to come a time that the temple would be destroyed, the Holy of Holies, not above ground, but underneath, the Holy of Holies would always be there. And the ark would always be there. The foundation of the temple would always be there, and he's still there today. We don't have a temple. We don't have the Western Wall that we can see. But the ark is still there. It's still there in the Holy of Holies, not above ground, but below ground. So in fact, what King Solomon was doing is he was guaranteeing the eternity, not of the whole temple, because that wasn't in his control, but he was guaranteeing the eternity of the foundation, the holiest spot, the essence of the temple. Now, I'm going to explain why I'm sharing this to you in a moment, because it's very relevant to the topic. That's the idea. Now, what has it got to do with what we're talking about? We know that the principle that we always talk about is the concept that the head rules the heart. This is what the whole essence of Edith Eger's work was, and Viktor Frankl, and so many others, right? So if we take the three layers of the temple, and we take our own temple, you know, sometimes we engage in negative behavior. Sometimes we get trapped in a negative emotional pattern and we feel very stuck. Sometimes we feel so stuck that we don't even think we can think straight anymore. We don't see how it's possible to re-engage in positive thinking. We don't see how it's possible to create positive thinking patterns. And here's the lesson from the temple. The way God designed us, the way God designed the human being, is that even though consciously sometimes when we feel all trapped, there's one part of us that is always there, the essence of the temple. The ability to build a healthy mind is always there. It's not always above ground. It's below ground sometimes. It's deep in our consciousness, deep in our subconsciousness sometimes. But we can do it. We can apply the principles that we're going to talk about. We can never, ever say with confidence that I am trapped and it's impossible for me to untrap myself. Difficult, yes. Need the help of others, yes. Needs a long process, absolutely. But it's always possible, because the one part of the temple that was never destroyed, it just went underground, was the Holy of Holies, the place of the mind, the place of values, the place of conviction, the place of a healthy mind, was never destroyed. It did go underground, but it's never destroyed. So I want to just, before I go into the first thing of what she talks about, when I was reading this book, I was thinking about, why is this so difficult for a lot of people? Why do we find it so hard to let go? Why do we find it so hard to engage in a strong mind and to build healthy, positive mind patterns and mind messages and so on? Part of the reason is because we live in a society now that we're so rushed and so pressured and so focused on outcome and so focused on doing that we actually don't make time to think. We actually don't do that enough, at least. We don't make time to think. Now, some people, of course, do, but at large, there's a decline in actually creating space for the mind, creating space to connect with the mind, creating space to dig deeper and to connect to that arc which is sometimes beneath the ground, but it's still there. We don't do that enough. And that's why I think, as an introduction to what we're going to discuss over the next number of weeks, maybe this is something we need to actually think about. And I would venture to say that maybe in lockdown it's a bit easier to think about it, or to make time for it at least. But we can't, hopefully we're going to get out of this soon. I know it's going to be for another 2 weeks, but we need to move on from this. Please God, very soon. But we should never forget that we need to create space to think. I mean, in Jewish experience, we have times built in for that. We don't always use it properly, but we do have times. A time of prayer, prayer, for example, is a time of reflection. We are taught that before we go to sleep at night, we're supposed to spend time reflecting on the day. We're supposed to spend time planning for a better day. We're supposed to do it once a month. We're supposed to do it once a week, maybe. Of course, we're coming up soon to the month of Elul and Rosh Hashanah, a time of reflection. We need time. No, we mustn't obsess. We must get on with the job and we must do and act, but we need time to think. So none of this will work unless we set aside consciously, and maybe we need to do this consciously. We need to set aside time to reflect. Reflection means to reflect on the past. Like, how did I do in that experience? What are the issues that are standing in my way? What are the patterns in my mind that I'm engaging in which are not healthy and blocking me? And what are the things I need to change? What are the things I need to let go of? What are my values and how am I going to get to my values? Excuse me, through positive thinking and healthy mindsets. But it won't happen just by talking about it a little bit. It actually needs time to think about it again, to process it, to internalize. Because to be mentally strong requires time, requires a process. And that's why I just want to emphasize that tremendously. That as human beings who want to grow, we actually need time to set aside to process information, to think about things, to know what we have to connect to and let go of, and so on and so forth. So that's the introduction. So that's for today. I'm normally going to try to do more than one a week because there's 13 things. We're not going to do this for 13 weeks. But for today, we'll just do chapter 1. Again, the book is called 13 Things That Mentally Strong People Don't Do. So the first one, she says, what they don't do is they don't waste time feeling sorry for themselves. Essentially moving away from victimhood, right? She brings a nice quote from John Gardner, which says, self-pity is easily the most destructive of the non-pharmaceutical narcotics. It is addictive, gives momentary pleasure, and separates the victim from reality. Rabbi Sacks, in his book, The Home We Build Together, writes, the flight from responsibility into victimhood is the oldest of all human temptations. But it is negative, destructive, it robs us of trust in the world. It leads us to see fate as a conspiracy directed against us. It leads us to the impotence of anger and the anger of impotence. The best way of curing a victim is to help them cease to think of himself as a victim. And in another place in the book Future Tense, Rabbi Sacks writes, victims want the world to change, forgetting that it may be they who have to change. So in the book, the author, Amy Morin, talks about what often people do is they have a self-pity party. Now, again, we all experience challenge, we all experience pain, and again, this is much harder to do if a person has experienced real pain. Sadness is normal. It's a normal, healthy emotion. We need to experience sadness. Again, we've talked about this many times, but when people go through a challenge, they shouldn't deny pain. They should engage in it. They should grieve. They should feel the frustration. They should feel the pain or whatever it is. We need to each go through a process where we feel and we process those emotions and we express those emotions in a healthy way, right? But sometimes what happens is that while we do that, we then descend, and sometimes descend for too long until it becomes part of us and it starts to harm us. We descend in a self-pity party. So, for example, she gives a checklist of things that you can look at and see if you ever engage in them to know. And the truth is, we're all guilty of it sometimes, right? If we have a cluster of these things. So she says, for example, do you tend to think of your problems are worse than anyone else's? Right? We all do that sometimes. And then we think sometimes if it wasn't for bad luck, you're pretty sure you'd have no challenges at all. Which, of course, is not a Jewish concept. Problems seem to add up for you at a much faster rate than anyone else. My problems are much faster than anyone else. You're fairly certain that no one else truly understands how hard life really is for you, right? You sometimes choose to withdraw from leisure activities or social engagements so you can stay home and think about your problems. You're more likely to tell people what went wrong during your day rather than what went well. You often complain about things not being fair. You struggle to find anything to be grateful for sometimes. You think that other people are blessed with easier lives. You sometimes wonder if the world is out to get you. Now, important to note that some of these things have become worse for many reasons. One of the reasons it's become worse is because we're influenced by social media. Social media creates a perfect world out of my world, right? So a person gets up in the morning and they're feeling very self-pity. They're feeling sorry for themselves because they've experienced a problem, or they have a challenge. They've been fired from work, or they've broken up a relationship, or real tragedy, or just regular challenges, right? And then we open up, because we're addicted to these devices, so we open up our social media or Instagram or our Facebook, and we start scrolling. And what do you see there? You see a perfect world. You see a perfect world, which is one of the diseases of our society, that people feel the need to portray and to represent their perfect world outside of them on some device, where even though we know that the world is not perfect, right? So I think that also exacerbates that concept of, oh, everyone else's world is so perfect, look at my world, it's so bad and it's so terrible, it must be worse than anyone else's. So if any of these examples resonate, and I can speak for myself, some of them do some of the time, that's the type of thing we need to move away from. Because the basic principle, which we've said thousands of times, is, of course, that we need to understand and know that even if we can't alter our circumstances, which we very rarely can, we can alter our attitude, right? So why do we do that? Why do we tend to feel sorry for ourselves? So let's go through a couple of ideas. One is, sometimes, and she doesn't say this in the book, I'm just saying this, I'm adding some stuff. I'm going to go through three reasons. The second one is what she talks about in her book. The first one, why we sometimes engage in self-pity, but to an exaggerated level, which is unhealthy, is because sometimes we live in a world today as well where people and us, all of us, sometimes take ourselves too seriously. We take ourselves seriously because we become, and part of taking ourselves too seriously is we become entitled. And when we become entitled, and it's very much part of the disease of our times, when we become entitled, we then believe that if something happens to us or something turns out not the way we expected it to happen, it's because the whole world is out to get us. And we build up feelings of anger and resentment and jealousy and all kinds of things, all coming from that taking ourselves so seriously. One of the foundations of personal growth is humility, and I say humility in a healthy sense. Humility is that we're part of a group, we're part of a bigger picture, we have a God to look up to and to surrender to, and so on and so forth. And just to learn not to take ourselves that seriously, not to take every time someone looks at us the wrong way, to take it that seriously, not to be offended by every comment a person makes, and so on and so forth. Just chill, like, don't take yourself so seriously. And that's, when we take ourselves that seriously, that's part of the reason why we descend into the world of victimhood. But another reason, of course, and this is something that she writes in the book, is because it's a trap. Victimhood is a trap. Why is it a trap? Because it's an escape. And this is important to understand. You see, if we don't see ourselves as a victim, if we don't see it as everyone else's fault, or the world is out to get me, or my problems are bigger than everyone else's problems, then really the alternative to that is to look at our problems and to analyze them and to see what we can do about them. Part of that is scary. Part of that means confronting our own fears. Part of that means taking responsibility. Now, most of us understand that all of that is hard work. And many people don't want to go through that process of really working hard. Resilience on any level, even for small things, is hard work. Taking responsibility for the things we can take responsibility for. Our choices, our attitudes, our mind patterns. It is hard work. And therefore, as she writes, it's so easy to fall into the self-pity trap. As long as you feel sorry for yourself, you can delay any circumstances that will bring you face to face with your real feelings. You can avoid taking any responsibility for your actions. Feeling sorry for yourself can buy time instead of taking action or moving forward. Exaggerating how bad your situation is justifies why you shouldn't do anything to improve it. And she says, sometimes self-pity becomes an act of defiance. It's almost as if we assume something will change if we dig in our heels and remind the universe that we deserve better. So that's a very simple reason. And the only response to that is that we know that self-pity, as we saw from the quote before, provides ultimately temporary relief. You see, there's a good feeling of feeling self-pity and playing a victim. It does provide certain temporary relief, but we know that it provides long-term extreme pain. There's only one way to heal from any challenge. There's only one way to progress and to really become a better person and to develop a strong mind, to be able to be productive and positive and meaningful. There's only one way to do it, is to put in the work, to take the responsibility and to really work with our own mind to make the right choices and to process the right information. That's the only thing that can give us long-term meaning. Self-pity will give us temporary relief, but long-term pain. The third thing is, we often fall into a trap, I think coming from an insecurity, and perhaps combined with a weakening in our, I'm doing this now from a Jewish perspective, we forget, number one, our own value, our own self-value. And sometimes that is actually connected with the foundations of our own faith. Now, let me explain what I mean. The concept of emunah, the concept of faith. The concept of faith means that we believe that everything comes from God, as we've talked about many times. And we believe that everything, even the painful things, is difficult to understand, but sometimes it's there for some reason which we don't know, nor should we know, nor should we justify. This is spoken about a lot in terms of the upcoming, nationally, the upcoming special day of Tisha B'Av, the destruction and mourning of the persecution and tragedies of the Jewish nation throughout the ages. But it's important to understand that emunah, faith, is not an easy thing. It's not like, oh, believe in God. Some people look at emunah as an escape. It's not an escape. It actually takes a lot of effort. It really is. It's okay to believe when things are good. You know that story? I think I've told you before, but that story of someone that was driving around the city and was in late for a very important appointment, an urgent appointment, and couldn't find a parking spot. And is driving around the block time and time again, and suddenly turns to God and prays and says, God, look, I really need this parking spot. You know, and if you give it to me, if you provide me with a parking spot, I'm going to give extra charity. I'm going to say extra prayers. I'm going to put on tefillin. I'm going to put on mezuzah. And he's driving around. It's getting really urgent. And he makes another promise. And suddenly this great, beautiful, easy to access parking spot appears. And he turns to God and he says, God, don't worry. I found one already. Right. In other words, when things are good, if everything is good in our life, it's easy to believe. But it's harder. It's harder to access that emunah when things are tough. But yet, part of the emunah, and this is a hard thing to process. One of the foundations that we are taught in the Talmud is that God, when He gives us pain, He feels pain too. The Talmud says, with regard to the destruction of the temple and the exile that the Jews experienced, that God went with the Jewish people into exile. Now, part of that idea is to understand also that God is not only with the world when they're in pain, He's not only with the Jewish people when they're in pain, but He's with each of every one of us, because each and every one of us counts. And as long as we're alive, we are value, and we have value, and we have reason to exist, and we have a mission to fulfill, and we have a purpose to accomplish. even if things are very tough. We don't know why they're tough. We don't want them to be tough. We don't pray for challenges, as we said dozens of times. In fact, we pray every single day, and I pray to God, please don't test me. But nevertheless, when He does, we need to understand that it's from Him. And it's from Him because He believes that we can still exist with purpose. We can still thrive. We can still, with time, we can still contribute. Because if we're still alive, we have what to contribute. We have a purpose to fulfill. We have an amazing contribution to give to the world. And I saw an idea brought out so beautifully to explain this in an event that happened when the Jews were in the desert. When the Jews were in the desert, God told Moses a number of times to take a census, to count the Jewish people. To count the Jewish people. And we find two contradictory perspectives about counting the people. One is, the commentary Rashi tells us that why does God count the people a number of times during the desert? Rashi says, mitoch chibato. It's because God loves us. And when you love something, you count it many times. You always want to see it's still there and how much is still there. And so on. It's out of God's love. That's the one idea. Yet on the other hand, we find that God says that when counting people is a dangerous thing, you've got to be careful. In fact, we have a thing about not counting people. You know, in a shul, please God, we should make it back there soon. But in a shul, when you need to know if there's a minion, you don't count people. You don't say 1, 2, 3, 4. You say not one, not two. Or you say a verse that has the numbers of people corresponding. And so on and so forth, because there's a problem in counting people. So the answer to this is that it depends how you count them. And the answer lies in a secret. That if you look at the wording, when God instructs Moses to count the Jewish people, He says, Su'u et Rosh, lift their heads up. You see, when you take a census, two things can happen. Counting people sometimes devalues people because it just makes everyone just a number, part of a sum total. Almost that people are replaceable. Like these are the numbers of millions of people. It's a million and ten, it's 10 million, it's 13 million, whatever the case is. The individually has no place. But the other perspective of counting people is no, you count each individual because each individual counts. When God told Moses to count the Jewish people, He said, Su'u et Rosh, lift up their heads. In other words, when you count them, make sure that the message is clear. Make sure you're counting them because each of them is special. Each of them is unique. Each of them has a specific, unique, and important, and irreplaceable contribution to make to the universe, to make the world a better place, to contribute to meaning and purpose. Every person has that unique contribution. It starts with believing not only in everyone else, but it starts with believing in ourselves. And if we really internalized that mindset, that I, as long as I am here, I have what to contribute. As long as I am here, not only I have what to contribute, but I have what to contribute to the universe, to God's plan. I have what to give that no one else could. Because it's my mission. It might be similar to other people's mission, but it's my mission. And it's the way why God created me. It's my number. If we have that real mindset, that's one of the ingredients, one of the ideas to process to move away from self-pity. Now again, when I said self-pity, I didn't mean to move away from pain. There are times in our life that we have to feel pain. Unfortunately. It's part of the emotional progress that we make. But there's a difference between feeling pain and giving up hope. Victimhood, self-pity is an expression of despondency, of giving up hope. When we understand that as long as we're around, as long as we exist, as long as we are part of this universe, we have su'u et rosh, we have that unique contribution to give that no one else can, that allows us to sort of move away the concept of self-pity. So just to summarize before we finish off, self-pity comes sometimes because we just take ourselves much too seriously and become entitled. It's an escape to move away from responsibility and hard work. And it's also a lack of understanding of God's message to us that you are needed. You are needed because you have something to contribute that is different to everyone else. When we don't do that, if we, as she points out in the book, if we descend into the trap of self-pity and victimhood, the consequences are very negative, and it stands in our way, just to point them out, which talks about the, you know, the research on this and so on. It hinders a full life. It hinders living a life of meaning and purpose. It wastes our time. It leads to negative emotions. Unfortunately, self-pity and victimhood becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy, because we get just more and more into that spiral. What it does is it blocks dealing with other good emotions or other challenging emotions which can be used and expressed in a good way. It causes us to overlook and not to notice the good things in our life. And unfortunately, what it does is when we become a person of self-pity, and you would know, no one really wants to hang around people who are always wallowing in their own self-pity, it hinders relationships. And it's bad for relationships. Rabbi Sacks, and I'm not going to go through the whole thing, but in a very beautiful article about victimhood, he says that what makes us human, because he talks about a meeting that he had with someone that had such amazing challenge and yet was so resilient and able to move forward. And he says, how does a person do that? Not just, I mean, it's painful, you just don't forget the pain, but he says, this is what the human being is all about, and I'm going to read it to you. He says, in any given situation, we can look back or we can look forward. We can ask, why did this happen? And that looking for some cause in the past, which doesn't really help us anyway. Or we can ask, what then shall I do? And that involves looking forward, trying to work out some future destination, given that that is our standing point. He says, there's a massive difference between the two. I can't change the past, but I can change the future. What he means is, of course, we're not in control of the future either. But he means we can make choices that will affect how the future looks like and how we look ourselves in the future. I can see myself as an object acted on by forces of largely beyond my control. Looking forward, I see myself as a subject, choosing moral agent, deciding which path to take from here and where I want to eventually be. So going back just to the conclusion of this chapter in the book, and I said one of the things she does in the book is, she says we need to let go. Mentally strong people don't feel sorry for themselves all the time, but in order to do that, we need to process the concepts we've been talking about, but we also need to replace it with healthy perspectives and healthy behaviors. And what she suggests based on her research is, when we're going through a time that we're sort of starting to fall into the trap of self-pity, we need to do things, even though we don't want to, but we need to do things, because the things that we do eventually bring us better emotional response. We need to volunteer, she says, to help a worthy cause. We need to perform random acts of kindness. We need to just do things of active, like exercise, or just getting out there and taking care of ourselves, even physically. And what she says is we need to replace feelings of pity with feelings of gratitude. And that's why one of the ways to escape, again, the behavior, the perspective, the mindset is what we spoke about before. The behavior of getting out of the trap of self-pity is things like, as we know, and we've talked about these many times, and the research now backs it up, that it's so powerful, is something like keeping a gratitude journal. Often people who wallow in self-pity just think that nothing good has happened. We need to set aside time every day to highlight the things that are good in our life, to highlight the blessings, to say, to verbalize what we're grateful for. When we start to feel self-pity, we need to change the channel right away. Start thinking about those things that are good. Ask other people what they're grateful for. Have conversations that are blessing-focused. And teach our children and those that are around us to also be really, really grateful. And we know that gratitude is one of the most powerful things. A 2003 study tells us that people who feel gratitude don't get as sick as often as other people. It leads to positive emotions, and of course, it improves our social lives. And of course, in a Jewish perspective, when we understand the true meaning of gratitude and understanding that the blessings that we have, the parking spaces that we do find, not only our challenges, but the parking spaces that we do find, those beautiful parking spaces that we have, come from God, of course, we improve our relationship with Him as well, and we're able to make our lives that more meaningful and that more purposeful. So that's just one of the things he talks about that mentally strong people don't do, and the remaining 12 we'll explore and go through in the coming weeks. I want to just there's a lot happening. If you can stay tuned of the emails and the WhatsApp messages, we're doing some new stuff next week in like a morning mindfulness group and other stuff. So please stay tuned and have a wonderful day and a wonderful week. All the best, everyone.
Thank you, Rabbi.
You're very welcome.
Thank you.